You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the rogue deck builder. Each week, we design new decks in Modern and Pioneer. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, Cave Dam makes top 8 in the Modern Challenge with a Faithless Brewing original. Did our counter Tybalt list break the format? We've got all the details on Modern's newest tier deck, plus picks of the week in Pioneer. That's all coming up on episode 8 of Kaldheim Season. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joining you from a very frigid Minneapolis, joined as always by my guy on the left coast. He is Damon Alexander. Damon, what's up?
Hey, just had another weekend of sick pow at Stevens Pass and off to Sun Valley next week. So you guys will have to live a week without me.
Yeah, we're still trying to decide what we're going to do. But the man who will be here next week with me, no matter what, through thick and thin, is the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Cave Dan Online and the latest member of a top 8 in a Modern Challenge. Daniel Schriever, what is going on?
It's good to be here, David. I will never abandon you for sick pow or kung pow or anything like that.
It's good. I need someone I can count on in these the last vestiges of our COVID lockdown.
I mean, it was 64 and sunny here today in North Carolina. Yeah, everything I need is right here, just walking around the block 20 times like I do every day and pretending that this is normal life.
I think it got above zero for like a fraction of an hour on Sunday this last weekend. Other than that, it's been absolutely frigid. The cold snap is in and it's here for like another 7 to 8 days. So it's been pretty miserable.
And for those of you who are international, below zero is below zero Fahrenheit, which is like minus 20 or something in Celsius.
Yeah, Fahrenheit is the real temperature for actual human temperatures. Celsius is only used for scientific analysis.
It actually is. I think that the Celsius is stupid. It's too narrow a grain or too coarse a grain.
Yeah, exactly. Like if something's in the 20s, you might need a t-shirt or you might not or yeah, whatever. And if it's in the teens, but it's in the 70s, you know what to wear. Get it together, Europe. Come on. So we got a lot of news to get to. We want to give a quick shout out to our Patreon. You can support us at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. Just a reminder, everyone, we're trying out a new format here. We're going to 2x episodes a week. We're going to shoot to release them on Friday and Sunday. This episode is going to come out on Friday. That means we'll have a sister episode out in a couple days. Our focus this week is a look back on the sort of changes in the metagame, and B, kind of the thing that's on everybody's lips right now is the Tybalt deck that has taken over multiple formats, but the specific format we're interested in is Modern. Our very own CEO top 8ed the Modern Challenge this weekend, and he was way ahead of the curve last week with sort of some of the permutations that he was iterating on. Dan, why don't you kind of walk us through your thought process as you were approaching the challenge, and then maybe you can kind of give us some insights into the tournament as you saw it.
Yeah, I was hours ahead of the curve, 12 to 18 hours ahead of everybody else. Like in one of those zombie pandemic movies where the hero is like staying just one flight ahead of the zombie wave, except I wasn't trying to cure anything. I was just trying to, you know, rake in the ticks while I still could. Listeners will know from last week that we were focusing on Velki as our first card of the Kaldheim season. And since I tasked myself with Modern, I had already been interested in the theoretical concept of turn one Velki and what that could mean. And we talked at length about cascading into it and all the compromises you'd have to make to your deck and whether you can actually win if that's the only thing your deck does and you just hope to draw cards off their deck, that kind of thing. At the time, you know, people were still memeing with Tybalt's trickery and it was not really clear what the metagame was going to shape up to be. But if you recall, at the end of last week's flashback, I had arrived at a list that I actually liked quite a lot. It was Esper-based, the most important card being Ardent Plea. That's one of the 3-mana cascade options. But it dipped into red because that gives you access to a second cascader in Demonic Dread. I wasn't playing any green, but, you know, I talked about how, you know, that list was already performing well initially. I think I got 2-4-1s on Monday. And then, you know, the day after we recorded, I got a 5-0. And I was like, man, this is great. Desk feel is super powerful, mainly because in addition to getting to play this increasingly broken Tibalt interaction, you also get access to the most important blue cards that incidentally stop anyone else trying to cascade against you. Talking here mainly about Teferi Time Reveler. Teferi's static ability completely shuts down any opponent trying to cascade. The second most important card is Force of Negation. This also stops anyone trying to do an Ardent Plea or cast a Teferi against you. So if you have your deck that is already playing both Teferi and Force of Negation, you're already pretty much set up for the mirror. You have your own Tibalts and Ardent Pleas. You do need a second cascade card. You're already like halfway there, halfway to victory, it felt like. So I just wanted to keep running with this and tinker with it some more. By the end of the week, I think I was ready to abandon Demonic Dread because that card is frankly terrible, and switch to Violent Outburst, which did necessitate going to five colors. But I think it was, you know, the right thing to do. And I think what we've seen in the days since then is that, yeah, I think everyone agrees. You have to play Violent Outburst. You should not play Demonic Dread at all.
Yeah. And so one of the things we want to point out real quick here is when you talk about the mirror, what was happening was a bunch of streamers were posting basically like Jund lists with no two drops other than Valky. So they were playing the eight Cascaders and some Bloodbraid Elves at times. But they were missing some of the explosive plays and they were missing all the blue cards. So you were both Tibalting, but your deck was just Tibalting much better and was able to stop their Tibalting.
Right. So you could expect all these decks to have Simeon Spirit Guides, to have the option to do it on turn two or maybe even turn one if you have two Simeon Spirit Guides. Some number of Gemstone Caverns. I was always playing the full four. That does leave you with, I don't know, 12 to 20 slots to play with to round out the supporting core. And as strong as the Jund decks are, I mean, you can't argue with their results. A lot of people are just winning a lot with them. The fact is, in the Jund colors, you just don't have that many interactive options. So those decks, you'll see them leaning on Blood Moons, and maybe some creature removal, Bonecrusher Giants, Murderous Riders, that kind of thing. But they can't really stop an opponent from cascading on them. In that sense, it's like you have an insanely strong deck, but you leave yourself vulnerable in a mirror where you just don't have to do that. It turns out that the blue version, at least this was my hunch, the blue version was just as powerful, perhaps even more powerful, because it has so many tools to win the mirror and fight off hate pieces. So I was like very happy to just ride Teferi as far as I could. I think switching to the five-color version, it just felt right, and it felt like I was ready to take on the challenges on the weekend. So I played a first league with the five-color builds on Friday night. I got a 4-1. Damon, you actually took it for a spin too. Give me some feedback on it.
Yeah, fresh off of Dan's tweet storms about how you're spewing equity if you aren't playing this deck, you know, broke the format, et cetera, et cetera. Dan is always one for such grandiose verbiage. But yeah, I took the deck into a league, and I'm teasing because Dan actually hates it when people do that. And I rolled out a pretty quick 4-1. I beat the Jund Tibalt deck in the mirror. I just absolutely smoked Rakdos midrange. I don't know why people are playing that deck in this meta, honestly. I actually got crushed by this Reclaimer Primetime deck who just, they assembled this like Valakut kill lines, even with my active Tibalt out and Force Negation didn't stop it. One opponent just kind of didn't do anything that scooped and four color Uro pile was an easy 2-0. Violent Outburst is so good in these mirrors because you can double spell. And so all of a sudden you can overload counter spells that way. You can dodge your opponent's Force of Negation. You can during their, you know, sometimes on their upkeep on turn one, or whatever, you're casting Violent Outburst, and what do they have? You know, some people are starting to pack Spell Pierces, ourselves included, but not much else stops Tibalt. And the deck was just, yeah, just smokes people once Tibalt comes down. I didn't understand how good Tibalt is. I think we knew he was going to be pretty good coming down, but the thing is that when the game goes to like turn 5 or 6 or 7, every single cascade spell in your deck hits Tibalt, so you always have a bunch of kind of one-card combos. And then if you ever get to -8, which happens quite quickly, at some point in the game, you're drawing, you know, 10 plus cards. And you're not drawing 10 cards because that could be stopped by Narset or Counterspelled or Thoughtseized or whatever. They just go into the exile zone, confusing all observers or your opponent, but they're there. They're just untouchable and they don't have to worry about colors or anything. And so a -8 to draw that many cards is basically game winning. Some of the cards that you'll hit will be more Violent Outbursts, perhaps the one that you initially got your Tibalt with. And then, boom, you're ready for Tibalt round two. It's like the 3 mana you give off the down tick just immediately could be used to cast a Violent Outburst at worst.
Yeah, I definitely did not understand how good Tybalt was. You know, I thought Tybalt was only worth 4 or 4.5 mana or something. I was wrong. I think, David, you were saying he was more like a 5.5 mana Planeswalker. That's probably closer to true. This card is super, super powerful. And it's that ultimate line happens so quickly. Tybalt comes in on 5, upticks to 7, goes to 9, and then the next turn you can either ultimate and have a Tybalt on 1, or more commonly, like Damon's saying, you ultimate, recast a Violent Outburst, and you end up with another Tybalt on 7. So it's like you ultimate and you end up with the same card on 7.
Yeah. In the meantime, the +2 is hitting lands from both players' decks, and so you want to be quite mana hungry with all the cards you're drawing, and the thing is the Tybalt uptick supports that because it gives you both the lands and the spells. The minus will hit all the stray fetch lands, so the minus will always draw you 3 or 4 lands.
So how did you feel about this, the randomness of the build that I had at that point? To give people an idea, there's Teferi, Time Ravelers, Ardent Pleas, and Violent Outburst. That's kind of your core 12, 3 Force and Negations, 4 Simeon Spirit Guides. So now, what is that, 19 cards? And 4 Valkyries. You actually don't need all 4. Some lists can get away with only 3, but if you're expecting that Valkyrie might get countered in longer matches, you know, you might as well play 4, and who knows, maybe you'll snipe an Uro with a hard cast, naturally drawn Valkyrie. The remaining slots I chose to use on just miscellaneous interactions, so 2 Brazen Borrowers, 3 Spell Quellers, Supreme Verdict, an Omnath, an Hour of Promise, a Mystical Dispute. And there's also a Saloon Division that probably shouldn't be there. I just wanted another blue source in my land slots so that I could pitch to Force more easily, and a Bonecrusher Giant. So those are all fine cards, but then in the sideboard, I just have all these miscellaneous one-ofs to interact with stuff, including an Uro in the sideboard. Like more Bonecrusher Giants, more Mystical Disputes, Wear Terror, Rough and Tumble, another Verdict, a Colligan's Command, a Skyclave Apparition. It just looks like a nonsense Niv-Mizzet sideboard. I'm curious, Damon, like what you thought of this approach.
Yeah, so a lot of decks we play are built with this kind of consistency in mind. And this deck has a very consistent A plan, but the supporting cast is somehow, even compared to Niv-Mizzet, even though it has a bunch of these random one-ofs or whatever, that deck would kind of play with a purpose. And this deck would just be like, oh, I have a spell queller. Okay, we're going to quell some spells, I guess. And then like the Omnath would show up sometimes. And there was an Uro to start with. And so it was like, they all work. But now that as the meta rotates, I can see how some of the changes need to evolve with it. You know, we had this Field of the Dead, which felt great when you run into the Field of the Dead mirror to have access to your own Field of the Dead. So if you, for example, use Tybalt to exile their Primeval Titan or Hour of Promise, then you can, you know, start leveraging your own mana base. You don't have to Tybalt into their Field of the Dead or whatever. The meta has definitely shifted since the last 2 weeks. I mean, obviously, you see a lot less prime time. You see a lot less games dominated by Field of the Dead. And so some of these choices, I think, are a little bit less correct now. The Spell Quellers never quite really clicked for me. They just kind of happened at the wrong spot on the curve in the sense that if you have 3 mana, your choice is to hold up mana to Spell Quell or to just cast a Tybalt. You know, there's one right line there, and it's not Spell Queller.
Right. This list, which I played on both Saturday and Sunday, was, I think, a reflection of my week of testing in the sense that I still expected to have to beat the field at large. And I was trying to imagine how each of the different meta decks in Modern might come after the Cascade strategy. You know, the different hate cards they might bring, like, oh, maybe they'll bring Pithing Needles. Maybe they'll have Deafening Silence. Or maybe they'll just try a Go Wide strategy, Fire-Risking Revoker, all these different things. Maybe they'll bring their own Teferis. So I kind of just liked having miscellaneous removal to be a little bit unpredictable. So that if they skew too hard to stop the Cascade angle, you know, maybe they'll just die to Bonecrusher Giants. Maybe they'll keep a hand thinking it's got a Teferi, and then I'll just play a Vraska Golgari Queen and eat the Teferi. I think what's happened since then is that the meta has shifted so much towards Cascade that you don't actually need all this miscellaneous stuff. I think the field has shrunk, at least in the challenges, especially if you just look at the Sunday challenge compared to the Saturday challenge. It's all Cascade. And there are more specialized tools that you can use if you're expecting most of your matches to be against Cascade. So yeah, I think this could be updated to reflect some of that if this continues for another week.
Yeah, so after our Friday night runs in leagues and some discussion over the kind of final card choices, you went into the challenge. And so just tell us a little bit how that went. We know you top 8ed, of course. We spoiled that at the very beginning. But
yeah, I mean, it was a lot of fun. I had not played a challenge in a long time. usually we just don't have a list that we've iterated on enough that I feel like it's worth it to take the time. You know, you have to basically have to set aside your whole day. These usually are minimum 7 rounds, possibly plus top 8. And these are not league rounds where as soon as you finish, you start again. You have to wait for everyone to finish. So I basically wanted to just take my shot because I felt like in this case, I had a very good read on what the best deck was. I had a list that made sense to me. I kind of knew how I was going to sideboard with it, how I was going to approach each matchup. And I've been paying pretty close attention to what other builds were doing. So I just felt very prepared for the tournament. And yeah, I mean, the matches themselves went great. I started off matches against Hardened Scales, against Is It Blitz. In the third round, I played against Doom Switch, who was Uro version of the Tibalt Cascade deck. I won that one very easily. And actually, he ended up winning the next day's event. And I played him the next day as well. But in the head-to-head, I felt like I had the right tools for the matchup, at least as our decks were set up at the time. So I started off 3-0. The fourth round, I got paired against Burn. And that was one matchup where I had, earlier in the week, I had set up my sideboard with a heavy anti-Burn bias. I had 3 core Firewalkers on the sideboard, and my plan was to just take out all the Valkyries and cascade into Firewalkers because A, I felt like my matchup spread was so good that I could afford to dedicate that many slots to it, and B, you know, Burn has a pretty good plan against Tybalt of just ignoring Tybalt and going to your face. However, by the end of the week, I hadn't seen Burn in a while, and I just assumed no one was going to play it, so I just took those Firewalkers out. And of course, the challenge rolls around that I got punished and just got crushed by Burn. Not crushed, actually. I probably could have or might have won, but I didn't play the best and I ended up losing that match. But rallied the next 3 rounds. I beat TSP Gendrek on a cool Snow Delver list. I beat Rakdos Pyromancer and a Hammer Time list in my Win It In, where I won that match with 5 seconds left on the clock. So it was a very stressful Win It In round, but finished 6-1, got into the top 8 as a 5th seed. Promptly faced a mirror match that was even more teched out than I was. I played against the version of Blue Tybalt that actually plays Commandeer, 2 or 3 Commandeers in the main deck, and a bunch of weird split cards like Warrant Warden and Far and Away. Basically just cards that pitch to Commandeer, in addition to Brazen Borrowers to bounce Tybalts, and of course your Force of Negations, your Teferis. So having that second free spell that doesn't just counter your Tybalt, but actually steals it, was disastrous, and I just lost very quickly. I mean, I knew what they were up to. I'd seen this list. It was published in a prelim from Wednesday. It was that same list, but the games just didn't go my way.
Yeah, what's funny is that like for every time, Tybalt gets Commandeered, the Commandeer gets disputed, and that's a complete blowout. I mean, Commandeer has a real cost to play it.
I felt like that list was extremely greedy on lands. Like it was not playing nearly enough lands for my taste. But maybe if you think of Commandeer as just a land, a free spell is maybe as good as a land. Maybe that's all you need. Yeah, I mean, the results seem to be there for that. That variant continued to do well on Sunday. So there's also a Sunday challenge. It's at a time that's more friendly to Europeans. So for me, it started at 7 o'clock in the morning, which I'm never awake at 7 in the morning. Definitely not playing high-level Magic at 7 in the morning. But I liked my deck so much that I felt like I just want to take one more crack at it. Because, you got to take your shot. Maybe this Tybalt Cascade deck is only going to exist for 2 weeks or something. But it would have been nice to just be the one hoisting the trophy at the end. So I woke up at 6:45, just hit join with 1 minute to spare. Right away, round one, I'm paired up in a rematch against Doom Switch, that Tybalt Uro build. And boy, I played really, really badly. Doom Switch, of course, is a fantastic control player, a streamer, plays this style of deck all the time. But I managed to make a misplay in game one that lost me the entire match. Like I was slightly ahead. I knew what I had to do. I was going to ultimate my Tybalts. I was going to play my 5th land, play Hour of Promise, and make 3 zombies. And what I did instead was I played the land in the wrong order. So I played the Hour of Promise first, which you should never do that because you miss the zombie trigger. And then when I went to click on my land off the Tybalt ultimate, I was still groggy. I checked which lands I had in play, and I just accidentally clicked on a duplicate land. So instead of ending up with 3 zombies, I ended up with 1 zombie. And I went from being slightly ahead to just at parity. And then like 12 minutes later, I lost that game and just didn't have enough time to finish the match. I think I won game 2 pretty handily. And game 3, I had 1.5 minutes left. So did not win that one, timed out. And Doom Switch went on to sneak in as the 8th seed at 5-2. We both finished 5-2 in the Swiss, but he went on to win the event. So that's just how it goes sometimes. You know, the standings tell part of the story, but the battle is won and lost in the actual matches. That's why you got to play them. So kudos to them. the rest of the event, well, I got paired against Tibalt's Trickery in round two, Blue Moon in round three. Those were pretty confident wins. I have a lot of tools against them. Death and Taxes in round four. This is a matchup that I'm actually yet to win. I think I'm 0-3 against Death and Taxes. And the way that these tend to go is you always feel like you probably should have won, but at the end of the day, you're left with, like, you know, a close 2-1 loss, and you're wondering what happened. And in this case, you know, I remember misplaying in game two, but I can't really say for sure if this is a good matchup or not. You know, they have a lot of tools against the Cascade deck. They have Thalia to slow you down. They have Archon of Emeria to slow you down. They have Leon and Arbiter to attack your mana. And if you do land a Tibalt, they can just Flicker Wisp it and reset your Tibalt and Giver of Ruins to protect all of that. So it's actually quite a complicated matchup where you really need to draw a Supreme Verdict to just clean up the mess. And I only had two of those on my list, and I didn't find them in those games. That being said, I rallied to win my last three and finish at 5-2.
The casual 2-1 against a deck noted as Anti-Cascade Prison.
Right. I do have to give a shout out to this player. This was Tweedle. Tweedle, best known for winning two challenges in the same weekend on Mono Red a couple months ago. Tweedle apparently is sick of Cascade. They played in game one, turn two, Aethersworn Canonist. Turn three, another Aethersworn Canonist. Turn four, Dranith Magistrate. Then Thalia and Magus of the Moons. It was an insane build. And then in game two, they brought in Deafening Silences. And I mean, I'm sorry to say that I probably broke Tweedle's spirit, ended their whole career, because I easily won the match. Just like Teferi is so good. Teferi just cleans up everything that they're trying to do. And then, you know, Vraska came down and cleaned up the rest. And all you have to do is just get one turn to land the Tibalt. You got to take the pieces off the board for one turn, land a Tibalt, and you're so far ahead. Maybe they pithy needle the Tibalt or something, but it doesn't matter because you've got more Teferis. You're just drawing so many cards. You got Brazen Borrowers, Skyclave Apparitions. So this is a matchup where just my random sideboard just really came through. They just died of Bonecrusher Giants. So, I mean, at the end of the day, it was, I think, a 19th place finish. And I mean, I was disappointed to not be hoisting the trophy, but I mean, you got to call these a success. I was really happy. A list that we started iterating on just as kind of a thought experiment from the All-In Tibalt to see it become just the best deck. Obviously, a lot of people working on the similar idea. Just the path that our list took, it was great.
Yeah, and I think everybody's kind of a buzz about, you know, what Wizards is going to do. We're recording this on Tuesday. There were no updates yesterday, Monday. They no longer need to schedule updates to the format anymore, so they can every Monday do whatever they want with some or no notice. At this point, I don't think the metagame can do much to iterate against it. You just described sort of an anti-Cascade deck that lost. The games are often resolved on turn, you know, two and a half. So it's not like you get to see a large amount of your deck even before you're forced to sort of interact with this particular combo, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, and the thing is that, like, you're like, oh, it's a spell-based combo deck. You know, what's good against that? Some sort of deck that plays a bunch of blue control cards. And then we look at these results, and it's like Dimir Delver 2-0, Blue Moon 2-0. You play the matches, and yeah, like, in theory, they have the cards to stop your Tibalt from coming down. But in practice, you're leading on Gemstone's Caverns and casting Violent Outbursts during their upkeep. And if they happen to have a Fluster, or not even Fluster Storm, they happen to have the exact spell Pierce, then you untap and play Ardent Plea, and they're tapped out. And maybe they have a Force. At this point, they're so far down on cards that the next one you cast a Teferi, and you just end the game, because they can never be resolved Teferi.
It's just too much to ask for other decks to have the exact right interaction at all the right times. And the Cascade decks get to play 8 of this 3-mana busted Planeswalker.
Yeah, and so you're getting, you know, whatever, a 5.5-mana Planeswalker on turn 2. And you get to play 8 of them, but they're never rotting in your hand, and some of them are at instant speed somehow. Yeah, and then somehow, like, Teferi is supposed to be the good guy when it's maybe the most miserable card they've ever designed. So, yeah, it's a topsy-turvy world.
Yeah, Oko is no longer the best 3 CMC Planeswalker.
If Teferi did not exist, I think the rest of the field would have so much of a better matchup against Cascade. The fact that you just can't rely on any permanent to stick around. Like, all the Cascade decks are already playing at least 3, probably 4 Teferi's main deck. So they're just going to bounce your thing when they're ready to go off.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of jokingly saying Teferi's a good guy. Like, Teferi blanking the card type, unless it is actually a Planeswalker, is one of the, like, 17 terrible things about that card. It used to be you'd have to have the, like, right answer for the right card, but Teferi just gets rid of anything. It's like, oh, I'm going to play an enchantment. They're not ready for that. No, Teferi's ready for that. Like, is it a card type that's not Planeswalker? Then Teferi can interact with it.
Yeah, the only good answer is your own Teferi. And then, even then, like, you know, I had a Skyclave Apparition. I had a Vraska. Like, there's There's just no one permanent you can have in play that's going to protect you.
Yeah.
So I think that the best way, you know, if you're going to try to win a tournament and you just don't want to play this, you can try burn or a really fast red deck. Just don't attack Teferi. Don't do that. That's a trap. Just attack them. I think another good deck would be blue-black mill. If you can surgical the Teferi in game one, you're actually in a pretty good shape. And maybe Death and Taxes if you're a master. Beyond that, I don't really see a lot of decks with good matchups against this.
So do you think Wizards tries to address this with a ban, specifically perhaps Simeon Spirit Guide or Valky himself? Or are they going to alter the rules, which is the more common, I think, path people would hope that they take? The Cascade interaction is pretty capricious and arbitrary, as are most of the crucial rulings that make cards good or bad in Modern. They'd obviously thought about it. Matt Tabak, the rules guru at Wizards, was very explicit in a text the day it was spoiled that Cascade worked with it. So they were conscious of that, at least. But it'd be very trivial for them to change the verbiage such that Cascade no longer worked. Like, would banning Simeon Spirit Guide do it? It slows the deck down, perhaps by a turn?
Yeah, I don't think it would. Just speaking for myself, I would side out the Simeon Spirit Guides often. If I felt like the matchup was not going to be about speed, I would just side them out. And that is also related to the Gemstone Caverns question. I started with four because I thought that I needed to be like a cheaty deck. But the more you play it, the more you realize your deck is so powerful, you don't need to cheat. You don't need to get lucky. You just need consistent colors and land drops. And so you'll see lists that just play like one Caverns, two Caverns. I don't even think you need Simeon Spirit Guide, at least in the control versions, because you have Force of Negation to interact early. The adventure creatures are so, so good. And if you really are worried about getting overrun, Dismember is another option for one mana. So you can just buy time that way.
Yeah. I mean, if you're WotC, you could envision some future that says, well, if you ban Spirit Guide or maybe even Gemstone Caverns, that card is so just, that card just really, I don't have the words for how weird that card is. Like, oh, you're on the play? Haha. No, I'm on the play.
That card was designed by the winner of the Magic Invitational.
Yeah, it's both extremely fair and extremely unfair at the same time. It's kind of like a paradox. You can, in theory, envision a future where if you ban Simeon Spirit Guide or whatever, slow the deck down a turn or so, that like a deck like Tron, you know, Karn doesn't give two. Karn beats Tibalt. And you have the Force of Negations, but it would be an interesting match.
You have Commandeer, you're pre-boarded against Karn.
That's true. Just more Commandeers. There are decks that, you know, speed does matter against Burn, trying to resolve Rolling Vortexes or Vortices, I guess, at that point. Maybe the primetime decks can come back a bit. The thing is that the blue decks beat the Jund Valky decks. The Jund Valky decks are the ones playing all the Blood Moons. And so if those get chased out of the format by the blue versions, then, you know, Primeval Titan Valakut is actually pretty good against Tibalt, especially with like the Valakut scapeshift type thing. Sometimes you can just get there without really relying on spells too much. You can even play Veil of Summer in that sort of deck.
David, what do you think they're likely to do?
I expect them to announce a rule change on Monday that the, I don't know if it'll change the verbiage on Cascade itself or the way that they choose to count the CMC of the card. This has some precedent. You know, they changed the way split cards are mana costed. Used to be able to do like brain in the jar tricks with them. You can't do that anymore. Obviously, Cascade doesn't hit cards that used to hit. You can't put certain cards underneath the two-man artifact that lets you cast it over and over again. Even flip cards like Delver, when it was flipped, used to have a CMC of zero. Now it has the same CMC as the front half of the card. So all those are instances where they didn't, even the like the flip version of Delver, that information isn't actually visible on the card, and they still had the casting cost reflect something that is invisible on the card. So I think there's precedent, or whatever, what we call it, a loose precedent, if you combine all those, to just suggest that Valky somehow has a CMC of 9 when it's not on the stack or something.
Oh, it's going to ruin my Dark Confidant Valky deck. No.
I mean, it's going to feel clunky, but I honestly feel like every time cards like this come out, we just like have to wait for these super long, like winded explanations of why a card works or doesn't work. They even eroded the expertise cycle. It actually used to be able to function with a card like Valky because it said card. They changed the word to spell in their errata. So all this stuff kind of leads me to believe it's a pretty simple fix, honestly. I think Valky as a design is actually really is doing what it's supposed to do. It's very good and standard, but it's not broken. It is a split card in the truest sense of the word, where each half is not quite as good as you'd want to be at that cost, but you can do either one. And the tricks to like actually resolve Valky and then bounce it or whatever, even the Niv-Mizzet decks casting it for 5 mana actually feels pretty fair. Maybe that's the quote unquote least fair way, is you're probably getting like a 5¾ mana planeswalker for 5 mana, but you have to build your deck with like a terrible mana base and these, you know, you're exposing yourself in a bunch of different ways. So I'm suspecting that's what they happen. I do have to say, everyone bitching about fire design, which as listeners of this podcast know I love to do, this is not an example of that to me. I don't think they should be spending time analyzing every random old mechanic. I think the card is working perfectly in standard, which is what separates it from cards like Uro and Omnath and Fires of Invention and Fairy. Like, all those cards had to get banned in standard. Valky is not even close to being the best card in standard. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. Standard's great right now. So I don't think you can call this a fire design. It does have a shit ton of text. If you look at the card in Gatherer, it is literally like reading the Quran or something. I mean, you're flipping through pages and pages and all these cases. So you just change a few of those words in there, 2% of them, and you have a card that's perfectly fine. And then it does what you want it to do. It is really good against Uro, against decks that don't pack removal. Yeah, that seems the cleanest path to me.
Yeah. And to be fair, these decks like weren't exactly discovered on day one. It took several weeks to evolve into the mess that is modern today. So I can kind of understand how you would miss this during testing or think, oh yeah, well, you know, playing no spells less than CMC3 is a real cost, but they just didn't figure out like the right version of the deck. I think changing the CMC of the card to be the sum makes a lot of sense. It's very consistent with split cards. There's a good argument that says that split cards and MDFCs are really the exact same concept, and it's just split cards work better for spells and MDFCs work better for permanents, but that they really shouldn't be treated differently in terms of like the sum of the casting cost.
Yeah, and I guess there'd be a few weird corner cases where, like, could you put Valky in your Lurrus deck? Then, you know, maybe not, because it's technically a permanent that has more than CMC2. Or if you had a Lurrus in play, can you cast just Valky from your graveyard? You know, but I don't give a crap about any of that. They can just decide if it works or not, however they decide.
Yeah, honestly, like, should you be able to play Valky in your Lurrus deck? The whole point of Lurrus is you only get to play cheap permanents, but now you get a 7-mana Planeswalker as your top end.
And to your point, Damon, I mean, it is exactly a split card, but instead of splitting the front half of the card, they just put something on the back instead of the front. It does, I mean, the functional equivalent is exactly the same. Fire ice is, as soon as you cast it fire, it doesn't matter that there was ice on it at some point. Same with Valky or Tybalt. So it seems like the cleanest fix to me.
I saw a tweet that said that you just can't do split cards for permanence because it doesn't really work
right
as a representation. And so you have to do MDFCs, but yeah. It is a split card. You could argue that all of Magic design is a split card, technically. You know, like Kicker is just a split card.
Yeah, kind of. So yeah, I actually think this set is well designed. I don't think Wizards should be castigated at all for Valky. I don't think they should be worrying about random mechanics. And it's easy enough to alter this. So it affected 2 weeks worth of testing. And really only the last week. The first week was ruined by Tybalt's Trickery, which is a card that they should not have actually designed.
Well, I don't want to tease the listeners too much before our Sunday episode comes out, but I will say you're spewing equity if you don't play our Sweet Magda list that I think totally broke Modern coming out of Kaldheim.
So, assuming some kind of change is made, maybe next week, maybe 2 weeks, or maybe in 3 months, does that mean that you'll never see Tybalt Cosmic Imposter again? I think it's likely that whatever change is made will still work with some cards. And David, the Release of the Winds deck that you were playing would be one possible home. So maybe this is a good place to segue and just talk about our picks of the week.
Yeah, so I'll do mine first because it does segue into that. I played my blue-black Valky list to a 3-2 or 2-3 last week. And the times when I was actually released to the winds in Valky on turn 3, it was very powerful. Also, just stealing Uro, flipping it into Uro and attacking on turn 3 happened multiple times. It even came up that I have a choice, like, do I want to turn this into Uro and attack, or do I want to get my sweet Planeswalker? What's better? But I had built it with a bunch of other stuff happening, and I was finding, especially once you flip Tybalt, all you want are cheap interactive spells. So I reconstructed the deck to just play a bunch of cheap interaction. You don't really need to worry about a win condition. You'll eventually find something. And I took this new and improved version back into the queues, and it felt awesome. I went 4-1. I only lost to Urien Transmogrify And it was just a classic, like in game three, I was way ahead and they had to nut draw like three perfect draws in a row. And I didn't have a counterspell for the third one, even with my flipped Planeswalker, you know, looking at three cards a turn. So it felt great. So that leads into Mental Misstep played a very cool Valky Release to the Winds list. They basically don't have a way to win, which is like super interesting to me. I guess you could technically attack with your like second Valky. But yeah, so they are a Lurrus deck. Their only creatures are four Jace, four Valky. I was also playing four of each of those. I was playing a few extra to Allrend, which is quite good against aggro. They just loaded up on some of the cheap interaction I was describing. They were also main decking Duress, which I was doing. They were also main decking Eliminate, which I was doing. They are playing four Dig Through Time, which is obviously a super powerful card. It's not a great card to flip a lot of times with Valky or Tybalt because you end up exiling all the graveyards. But I think in your non-Valky flip games, it's going to be very good. And so, yeah, they basically just have to like find a card from their opponent's deck that wins. They can't actually really do it in their 75. But yeah, I thought this was a super cool list. I'd like to try it. My first impulse is that Dig Through Time is just really powerful, so maybe it's just better than mine. One thing I don't like is I wasn't playing any tap lands. I really like being able to go Duress or Thoughtseize turn one, Valky turn two, Release to the Winds turn three. They're way less likely to do that with four Fabled Passage, but they need to play the four Fabled Passage to fuel the Dig Through Time. And I don't know if the Lurrus is worth it either, but this is a super cool list. It's not like any other list that we've seen in the Pioneer format. And they did go 5-1 in the Pioneer Challenge. So awesome job by Mental Misstep.
It didn't occur to me that there's no actual win condition here. So you had Allruns where this deck maybe has Dig Through Times and other removal spells. Are you willing to give up the Allruns?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing about Allrend is it does... I was playing one Mox Amber, which came up a couple of times. Allrend was awesome against green aggro, red aggro. I don't think that Lurrus is very good in a list like this. Like, buying back extra Valkys just doesn't do anything. And, like, Lurrus is when you don't have anything to do with your mana. But we're playing Jace and Dig Through Time and Valky flipping into Tybalt. So I was tapping out every turn. I never had three mana available. So I don't know if Lurrus is worth it. I'm not saying that Allrend needs to be the extra card, but I'm not that interested in Lurrus, especially because a lot of the sideboard cards I want to play against aggro, I really want to play Cletus, for instance. Then I'm happy to cut Lurrus for that. So, but I like the idea of playing Dig Through Time. So I don't know. I don't know. I mean, how are you winning these games? It is true that most people just threw down after I had accumulated a ton of value. So maybe you just have to like count on your opponent. But if you play a mirror match with this, like the match is going to go to time. There's just no way around it. Maybe you deck in like games 2 and 3. I mean, it's crazy.
There's 11 total power in the deck. That seems like enough to make some progress. I've killed plenty of people with Snapcaster Mages. You're missing out on the Ardent Pleas to pump your Valkys, though.
Yeah, that's big. I guess you have one Colgan's Command that can do 2 damage.
Yeah.
You can only have one Valky in play, though. You can have multiple Snapcaster Mages in play.
What's interesting is Mental Misstep really values these Colgan commands. They're the only red spells in the list, and they're playing 4 shocks to support it.
Well, you need to play some amount of red just in case you have to hard cast Valky anyway. I think I was playing 3 red sources in my list. So if you're doing that anyway, maybe the one Culligan's Command is worth it. I think that's reasonable.
Oh, that's fair.
What about you, Damon? What's your pick of the week?
Yeah, so I am going to pick a Mardu stuff deck in Pioneer coming from Nolan Sanity. So I guess just like me, this person went a little bit deep on Tenet. They got a 5-1 in the challenge, so that's a great result. I'm not sure if actually MTG was rendering it properly or MTG Goldfish. It might be a 5-2.
I think that's correct. Often Goldfish misses the last round for some reason when they scrape and report the results.
Yeah, something like that. Or it just doesn't know how many rounds it is total, so it sees that there's 15 points, but not the round total, so it just guesses. Especially maybe if like there's no player with 21 points, it doesn't know there were 7 rounds. Anyway, that's boring. The deck is sweet. It just plays all these cool Mardu cards, and what really seems to link it all together and make it exciting is the 4 Showdown of the Skalds in here, which is the new saga from Kaldheim that is like a Boros Escape to the Wilds, where you flip over your top 4 cards and can play them until next turn for a total of 4 mana. And then on your next 2 turns with a saga in play, every spell you cast gives a creature +1/+1 as a counter. And so the deck plays a lot of creatures and, you know, just name some good Mardu cards, name some less good Mardu cards. You know, we have Fourth Raven Inspector that can't go wrong there. Forest Gothic of Apparition. It features some Valkyries just in the most fair way possible, so that your opponent's table can exile them or something. And then four Mire Triton to fuel four Kroxa. And then a couple Lilies, a couple Chandras. And then four Fatal Push, four Thoughtseize because you're playing the best spells and the best color in Pioneer.
Help me make sense of the Mire Tritons here.
Yeah, my thought is that Mire Triton is like a Citrus Supplier, but if you're not going to sack the Citrus Supplier, Mire Triton trades. So that's like your one anti-aggro card. And then you need a body that's a reasonable place to put all your like Showdown of the Scalds counters is all I can think. So like Mire Triton and Thraben Inspector are the ones that kind of end up shouldering that burden for your deck. It's all I can think of.
Yeah, Mire Triton doesn't do one thing extremely well. It does a lot of little things.
It did look like red decks were on top of the metagame right now, both mono red and like a Boros Feather strategy. So maybe it's a metagame call.
Yeah, I mean, it always trades. They're even playing to Liliana the Last Hope. And so if you Mire Triton mill two, trade with whatever giant green or red creature your opponent has, minus two your Liliana, get back Mire Triton, recast it. You've put six cards in your graveyard and you've gained four life. So that's something. I do like the use of Chandra Torcha of Defiance. That actually helps you cast the backside of Valky. So that's cool.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, what else are you going to play as your two CMC creature of choice? You know, could you squeeze Dreadhorde Arcanist in this list?
Yeah, there just aren't that many spells. There's only eight spells. So Young Pyromancer, Dreadhorde Arcanist, those are ones that like red-black Pyromancer, as we call it, would want to play. But because they're very permanent focused to try to take advantage of Showdown of the Scalds, I think maybe they're just forced to go a different direction.
Yeah, now that you mentioned it, it's such a creature-heavy deck. I keep thinking this is the red-black Pyromancer shell, but there's no Pyromancers in sight. There's no Arcanist in sight. There's only four push, four Thoughtseize. That's it. It's a really surprising collection of creatures here. But the Showdown triggers on any spell you cast on chapters 2 and 3. So I guess you could get a surprising amount of board presence. I just assume this would be splashing Scalds into the red-black shell, but it's much, much heavier weight.
Yeah, I mean, they're playing four Skyclave Apparition and Thraben Inspector, which you'd hope to play on one. They are playing four Triome. So yeah, it's an interesting list. It just looks way too fair to me, but it's awesome that Nolan Sandy was able to have that much success with such a fair deck. So maybe that tells you that if people were a little more experimental and Pioneer, they'd find more success instead of just sort of punting it away.
Or maybe it tells you that Showdown of the Scalds is unfair.
Well, it's unfair in the best kind of way then, where you're slowly accumulating cards and your opponent can't interact with them.
So my pick this week is also from Pioneer. I am picking a World Tree combo deck. I first saw this deck on the Sunny Days Discord from a player, Sam Bogue. He's a great brewer. We used to play in the IQ Circus together in Connecticut. But they were pushing hard on this World Tree combo list as like potentially one of the better decks in the Pioneer format. Now, it didn't crack the top 8 over the weekend. I think this build from Killer Sov ended up in 9th place and another one in 14th place. How does it work? Well, when we were talking about the World Tree during our preview episodes, I raised the possibility that maybe activating the ability is worth it for a deck like Wilderness Reclamation. You know, once you get to 6 lands, if one of them is a World Tree and you have a Reclamation down, you can activate the World Tree on your own end step. What are you going to get? And I was wondering if it was worth it to put in just random gods like Scarab God or Cosima or whatever you have to put in, Aegon, Elrond. Turns out that there's actually a game-winning combo. If you just put enough copies of Purphoros, God of the Forge, into play at the same time, they will all see each other and trigger. What does Purphoros do? This is the original Purphoros from Theros. So it turns on when your devotion to red is equal to 5. Otherwise, it's not a creature. It also has the static text, whenever another creature enters the battlefield under your control, Purphoros deals 2 damage to each opponent. So what you need to do is you need to activate World Tree, bring in enough gods to get up to 5 red devotion. So 4 of these are going to come from Purphoros, and the 5th one will come from another red god. In this case, it's Clothis. That means that the Purphoroses, even though they will legend rule each other, apparently they're alive long enough to see each other as creatures, and therefore all of them will trigger. So this deals lethal damage as soon as you activate the World Tree. So now we're talking about not just like a little bit of value off of a land, but actually a one-shot kill that is very difficult to interact with without very specific interaction. You need to, like, I guess, stifle the trigger, basically. Or option B is you fight them on mana and try to stop them from resolving Wilderness Reclamation. I think the first build that Sandbog built had a bunch of ramp cards like Hour of Promise and Elvish Rejuvenator and all that. And I was like, I'm surprised because I think Wilderness Reclamation is just much cleaner. And I'm not surprised that the build that they've arrived at here has cut all that stuff and just gone to Growth Spirals and Reclamations. And the rest of the deck is just, you know, the greatest hits of Pioneer and Standard. So Uros, Omnaths, Grazers, and all the rest.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So there were like six different Reclamation decks in the dump of 22 5-0 decks. One Sultai, five or four teamer, and then this one. I think a lot of just straight up teamer decks have adopted this and just abandoned the Omnath, Settle the Wreckage, Teferi. And then everything else, you can just play a much cleaner mana base, but you can play counter spells and more interaction. It'll be interesting to see which of these turns out to be the best version. There were some people that were just playing the normal Reclamation list without the World Tree combo. You do ask a lot of your deck because you have to put four Purphoroses that basically are blank pieces of cardboard unless they're part of the combo. So it's unlike Field of the Dead in one way where, yes, it is a land that's hard to interact with that does win the game, but it asks a lot more of your deck. You can't just play fetch lands and snow-covered basics and normal basics or whatever. You actually have to play four Purphoros. You have to play three Clothis. None of these are on game plan. It's very hard for this deck, or it's impossible for the deck to ever actually turn them on in the course of normal game actions to attack. They only are ever creatures as part of the World Tree combo.
Yeah. I watched some of the VODs of Canister, who ran this in the Sunday Pioneer Challenge. And I got to say, the deck is strong, but it's not, totally broken. He got absolutely crushed by spirits. They just counter the key spells and get in and kill you long before you can do your World Tree combo. And then he also, I mean, look at this list. How does this list ever beat Oops All Spells? And the answer is it doesn't. Although Canister did win one game one against them where they just totally attacked all into Settle the Wreckage. but otherwise it doesn't. It just doesn't have, there's not a single good piece of graveyard hate in the sideboard. You could in theory build it that way. You're playing a Urien deck that's hit or miss. And then otherwise, like, yeah, you have these blanks and these decks just have a lot of, you know, Arboreal Grazers and the Uros drawing you into lands and they flood out or whatever. They don't have that many real spells in them. And now you have even fewer real spells. And so if you compare this to just like the typical kind of four color Uro, Omnath, whatever in Pioneer, this list doesn't feel like it has like a huge advantage. The ability to combo off as early as turn five or maybe even a little bit earlier if you have the right number of Grazers and Growth Spirals in the true nut draw is good. It's a strong thing to do, but it doesn't seem like this pushes the deck into like any tier zero territory.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think because you have the Purphoroses, you want to decrease your chance of drawing them. So they choose to play Urien. That makes sense. But then all the other great cards that you're hoping to draw when you're playing against them, the classic, if you want to call it, Uro Omnath list, you're like, man, I hope they don't draw Uro or Omnath. Well, they're going to draw them a lot less frequently now. And it's also very rare for them to draw Wilderness Reclamation, right? They aren't even playing Op. They don't have that many ways to find some of these crucial cards. I do want to flag that this is the exact kind of list that can only exist sometimes because Teferi exists. They're basically not playing any interaction at all. And I'm not surprised, like, Spirits was able to beat them. Just a normal, like, Flash list would just be able to fade this. But if they ever resolve Teferi, it just beats Flash list entirely. So this is why Teferi should just never exist. I'm going to be advocating for a ban in every episode we have. If freaking Looter Scooter is going to be banned, I demand a Teferi ban.
That seems fair. I can co-sign on that.
Yeah, tit for tat. Or unban Looter Scooter. Let's just do it both ways. Simple. Classic. An eye for an eye.
Well, cool to see this combo actually work and put up some results. I don't know where it's going to go from here, and I'll be curious to see how the deck evolves. So I think that'll do it for our look back at this week, both Valky / Tybalt in Modern, a little bit of Valky in Pioneer, and some cool innovations happening also in the Pioneer format. Modern may be on fire, but Pioneer is actually looking sweet right now. If you're on Magic Online, there's plenty of good games to be had.
Absolutely. Until then, may your Cascades always hit a 7-mana Planeswalker on turn 2.
That's a wrap on episode 8 of Kaldheim Season. Tune in to our Sunday episode for brand new decklists featuring Birgi, God of Storytelling, and Harnfell, Horn of Bounty. You can follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. And if you'd like to support our show, you can join our community at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. Brewing is hard enough, so don't go it alone. Become a supporter and come brew with us. That's all for today. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you next time.
Has this ever happened to you? I can't figure out which Magic the Gathering podcast to listen to, and I'm no Spike.
Every Friday, the greatest minds in modern tech building come together to present Faithless Brewing, recorded in areas adjacent to Lumen Field in Seattle, Bank Stadium in Minneapolis, and the Gallo Motorsports Park in Benson,
North Carolina.
You'll hear all about cutting-edge modern technology with cards that have been described as modern legal by deck engineer Shallow Gray Day. Hear about developments in the format from Damon, Nuklaunch, Alexander, and Daniel the Caveman Shriever. Sick of going 05? These guys can help you 3-2 in style. And if listening to the podcast isn't good enough for you, access to the Discord is only $5.
$5?
$5. You can ask questions to experts, show them your decks, collaborate with peers, and participate in the nonsense of the Faithless Brewing Community League. Like burning rubber? Try burning tickets. Looking for better metagame analysis? Check out the Dive Down. That's right, don't be a downer, be a Dive Downer. With all the exciting action of spreadsheets. Faithless Brewing in the Dive Down. Check them out, or you might as well be dead.